Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Lancaster, Ohio was once an industrial engine of the Midwest, home to the venerable Anchor Hocking Glass Company. But corporate raiders, enthused by an era of unchecked capitalist verve in the 1980s, gutted both the company and, by proxy, the heart of the city of Lancaster. Journalist and author Brian Alexander grew up there during the good old days. He returned last year to write about the bad old days for his new book. It's entitled Glass House, The 1% Economy and the Shattering of the All-American Town. Brian Alexander joins us. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
We were just talking before we went on, and I want you to pick up from there. You wanted to write about something you were looking for. You had a lot of strings of ideas, and all of a sudden it occurred to you Lancaster embodied all of that.
Right. For a number of years, I've been wanting to write about threads that I thought I saw running through America. But they seemed somehow unrelated and yet still related. I couldn't make them cohere into one sort of good story. But then eventually it occurred to me that a lot of these threads are running right through the middle of my hometown where I grew up. And I thought, oh, my gosh, here's how you tell the story.
And how did that occur to you? Did you go back? Did you already know what was going on there?
In 2008, I went back to Lancaster really to accompany my mother, who wanted to return to visit some of her old friends during Lancaster Festival time in the summer. And I walked around downtown, saw a number of things that I thought were a little bit disturbing, drove around the town, didn't find a lot of kids out in parks or anything, even though it was a beautiful summer day. And I left just a little discomforted, and I began to follow events in the town. And then eventually I linked it up with some of these threads I was just talking about. And I thought, well, here it is. Here, all this time, it's been in my hometown.
You grew up there. So tell us what it was like, when that was, and what it was like then.
Well, I grew up in the 60s and 70s. I often tell my friends who live in big cities, I said, look, I lived in Leave It to Beaver land. And for me, that's the way it was. Now, it wasn't that way for every kid. I don't want to give the impression that this was a genuine utopia without any problems and so on. There were. I mean, there were occasional dysfunctional families, and Lancaster has always been a hard-drinking town, so occasionally there would be things like alcoholism and so on. But by and large, it was a town of kids on stingray bikes running around, shooting hoops in parks and going to swimming pools and ice skating in the winter, and everybody knew everybody, and you could go into the local drugstore on Main Street and Mr. Flaggy would get you a cherry Coke and he'd put it on your parents' tab. And this is the 60s and 70s, not the 20s and 30s. So to me, it really was kind of the cliched all-American town.
Your book follows the travails of a group of Lancastrians. How did you decide to focus on them? Tell us about the people you picked.
Well, they were representative people, but they were also people who, quite frankly, were available to me. I had met them through a variety of ways. There were people struggling with addiction. There were employees at Anchor Hocking. There were managers. And pivotally for me, the CEO at the time of Anchor Hocking, I had met with him. And I said, this is what I have in mind to do. I want to follow how you are trying to rescue the company. And he said, okay, you know, come on in. I'll give you some access, which was, it's a rare a treat to be able to have that. And that really put the book together for me.
I kept looking for the hitch there. There was no hitch. He just gave you access.
Gave me access. I mean, there were certain restrictions, things like I couldn't reveal sort of competitive, you know, inside plans and mm-hmm. that sort of thing. They don't want their competitors to know what they're doing. But he was very forthright and said, you know, this is the problems we've been having. Here's how we got where we are. Here's what we're going to try to do to save the company.
There's an interesting contrast between Sam Solomon, a black man in what you call the whitest town in America, and his successor at Anchor Hocking later. Sam Solomon seemed to get that the company could be viable. It could keep its roots in Lancaster. There was something there. But his predecessor, there's a really interesting passage, and you did a great job at just very literally and strictly quoting people, and I loved that about the book, that he's just kind of, he can't even comprehend why someone would spend that much time in Lancaster.
Right. Well, I think you're referring to the person who succeeded,
right,
Sam Solomon, who was an interim CEO, kind of really a high-paid consultant. He also saw great value in the company, and that he, you know, the company shouldn't be in the position where it is, very much as Sam's thinking. But what he couldn't get was how anybody works at the factory for 40 or 45 years. To him, that's an exotic, weird way of life, that you stay with one company. Because in our modern business sense, you're here for a little while, you're there for a little while, and everything is quite transactional. And so a sort of loyalty and community with a company almost doesn't exist for people like him.
And yet, it really is the foundation of that all-American city that you write about.
Right. And this is a key point of the book. Not only with Anchor Hocking, but Lancaster's other businesses throughout time, there's been a very strong symbiosis between the company and the town. Executives, their wives and families all lived in town. The kids went to school with the workers' kids. It was a blended community and very economically diverse community. It wouldn't be unusual for the CEO's kid to go to school with the factory guy's kid and be really good buddies with that guy.
You wrote a lot about the women of Lancaster, that they were, you know, the executives' wives and that kind of a thing. They were pretty highly educated, but they didn't work. But they made the town really what it is today, or the best parts of it what it is today.
Right. They didn't work in a career-type job, but they really poured their heart and souls into Lancaster. So if you were to go to Lancaster today and see some of the great restored antebellum buildings, including General Sherman's birthplace, his home, that was all restored by the ladies of the Fairfield Heritage Association, who were the wives of Anchor Hocking executives or Diamond Power executives, Lancaster Glass executives, and so on. When we needed new sidewalks, they agitated to get sidewalks. New school bond issues, they went out and campaigned for new schools. They really made that town work.
And politically, pretty mixed overall because of the unions or what? What was going on back then?
I refer to it as sort of an extreme moderates. I mean, people were basically either pro-labor union Democrats or moderate business-oriented Republicans. Now, obviously, there's been big realignment on our national parties, and that's now reflected. And so you have really quite conservative Republicans now. I mean, Fairfield County went basically 60-40 for Trump.
Right.
Not surprising they voted the Republican ticket. I was a little surprised at some of the real genuine enthusiasm for Trump. But it's always been a Republican town. I mean, my mother was the co-chairwoman for Congressman Clarence Miller's campaigns. Clarence had... He could just walk into office whenever he wanted to. He was going to get reelected no matter what, and until he was gerrymandered out of his own district. And Clarence was a moderate, economically conservative Republican.
Let's talk about what happened in the 80s when Carl Icahn and his ilk decided that the thing to do was to buy up companies, load them up with debt or strip them of their assets and move on.
In the case of Carl Icahn, he pulled what was then a classic green mail. So what he would do is go and target a company and buy at least 5% of their stock, say, I now have 5%. I want a board seat because I think you're not running the company properly. I want to agitate for change because we can increase the share price. Quite often, naturally enough, the CEOs or the board members would say, we don't want you on our board. We think we're doing okay. We want you to go away. And he would say, well, I could go away, but gee, I've got all this stock, hint, hint. And so maybe you should pay me a premium and buy me off. And that happened in case after case. So he targeted Anchor Hocking. Ultimately, Anchor Hocking paid him a premium. I calculated it to be about $3 million. So in a space of just a few months, Carl Icahn walked away with a $3 million profit without having actually contributed anything to the company in order to make that money. And as one of Carl Icahn's biographers has it, an Icahn aide said that the targeting of Anchor Hocking was like taking candy from a baby.
And, you know, Carl Icahn's an advisor to Donald Trump on finance, business and business finances and that sort of thing. This was the way it was back then. This was encouraged.
Oh, yeah. The Reagan administration was really very laissez-faire about this sort of thing. There was a view that said that maximum shareholder value is the only responsibility of business, and that through the invisible hand of the marketplace, almost like magic, that would trickle down and benefit everybody. That's not what happened.
I guess it depends on who you count as a shareholder. When I read your book, I definitely see the citizens of Lancaster as shareholders in Black Diamond, in Anchor Hocking, and all of that. But technically, there was no fiduciary responsibility to them.
Yeah, and you couldn't go to somebody in Lancaster and try to convince them of that, because Lancaster always felt that it was an owner of the company, whether it was Anchor Hocking or Lancaster Glass, whatever. At one point in time, one of the Anchor plants burnt down, an old plant called the Black Cat. This is in the 1920s. Lancasterians dug into their own pockets to raise money for a private company. Lancaster loaded up their cars with scrap glass during a period of a shortage of a critical mineral, and they drove into Anchor Hocking property to give a bunch of scrap glass. There was this very deep connection, and they felt they had a stake in Anchor Hocking as much as any shareholder did.
Mm-hmm. And so then Carl Icahn does the, what is it called,
Greenmail.
Greenmail. But then what that eventually led to was targeting Anchor Hocking as an easy mark. There's more to be done there.
When I first started this book, I consulted with a professor of business journalism to say, what kind of tips can you give me? And he said, here's what you need to do. You need to realize that this is a game. This is not sort of life and death or the lives of workers. This has become, since the 80s, a game. And you win or lose the game. There's not the connection with community that there used to be. And so Anchor Hocking basically put, and this is a term that's used, Carl Icahn put Anchor Hocking in play. And he put it in play in a sea that was now filled with sharks who were happy to go after anything that was in play. And Anchor Hocking fell victim to that.
It was bought out, or it was merged or bought out?
Well, they sold off one whole division that was basically half the company to an early version of private equity that was run by a former Treasury secretary named Bill Simon. He had an investment firm called Westray. And so the container division, bottles, jars, and so on, was sold off. So that leaves the company now half of its former size. And then it's taken over by a company called Newell that later became known as Newell Rubbermaid.
And Newell had philosophies about how they should operate these companies from afar, not from inside the city.
They fired every executive, closed down the headquarters. And what you do when you do that is you take a real core group of possible civic leaders and advisors and so on, and you rip them out of your community. And as we just discussed, their wives also. So now you're starting to really break the social fabric.
We are going to continue our conversation, not just about Lancaster, about all the Lancasters out there in the United States. We've been hearing from Brian Alexander. He is a journalist and the author of the new book. It's called Glass House, The 1% Economy and the Shattering of the All-American Town. Brian will be giving a free talk tonight at the OSU campus. For more information, go to a link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the rise and fall of Lancaster, Ohio, and its relationship to the glass company Anchor Hocking. At its peak, it was the world's largest maker of glassware, employing more than 5,000 residents in Lancaster. The good times mostly ended in 1987 when the Newell Corporation took over the company. In his new book, journalist and Lancaster native Brian Alexander argues that the terms of the acquisition and the aftermath of the takeover brought about the demise of his once thriving hometown. The The book is entitled Glass House, the 1% Economy and the Shattering of the All-American Town. Brian, thanks again for joining us. We're going to continue our conversation about the economics of what happened to Lancaster and the sociological impacts of what happened to Lancaster and how that's happening across the country. But first, I wanted you to read from your book. This is about the county fair, which I covered Lancaster. I covered Appalachia for the Columbus Dispatch for about a year and got to know Lancaster pretty well. And I loved the county fair. It was, you had to be there. So tell us, this is with the fair manager.
Yeah, everybody's got to go to the county fair.
Yeah.
And so the question I ask is, how is the county fair, this very traditional event, how is it still there and so thriving after 165 years, uninterrupted years? And this is the fair manager. His name was Dave Benson. Dave Benson believed the fair's unchanging focus on animals, dirt, and what people could do with the stuff that grew out of the dirt had saved it. To him, the fair was a living ode. "We have a lot of pride in Fairfield County," he said. "That person who baked that pie wants to let people know she is the best cherry pie maker in Fairfield County. That quilter wants others to know how talented she is, how imaginative she is. The man with his collection of antiques wants people to know how interested he is in preserving the items that are no longer here. People bring in something from a 1950s fair, a little banner or anchor-hawking glass. They want to show people they have pride in those items. People displaying their apples want others to know how bright and shiny they are. The hog farmer showing hogs has pride in his hogs. The fair," he said, "was about cooperation, smiling, and community, and reminiscing." Benson was the fair manager. He'd run it for the past 24 years. He calculated the budget in his small office, with Peggy Cummins looking over his shoulder from the Green Grass of Wyoming poster on the wall. He made schedules. He helped clean restrooms. His walkie-talkie chirped constantly between 5 a.m. and midnight. Just the other day, some people from Medina, Ohio, had come to the fair, found Benson, and commended him on how clean and tidy the grounds looked. He lived for such moments. Benson had spent 33 years working for the Ohio Department of Transportation, but he was raised on a farm just outside of town, 300 acres of dairy cows, hogs, corn, wheat, and a few chickens. There weren't many farms that small anymore. The land that hadn't been subdivided into tract houses had been consolidated into spreads of over 1,000 acres. You couldn't make a living working 300 acres, raising a little of this and a little of that. In a globalized world where soybean prices in Brazil affected import markets in China, you needed computerized combines, crop specialization, and the economy of scale to make it in agriculture. You had to be big. Benson's father and mother both exhibited at the county fair in the 1920s. He exhibited in the 1950s. His children exhibited. And, while he didn't make a career of farming, he held a tight grip on his nostalgia for what the fair had given him and his family. That's why, though he was officially only a part-time employee of the fair board, he always laughed when he said part-time, he worked 16-hour days. He was 76 years old. "I do it to give back to the community," he said, "for what it gave me as a child, and because I love to do it." Whenever he got the chance, Benson told local politicians the county fair was the cherry on top of Lancaster's fudge sundae. He didn't mean to imply that the fair was an economic boon. Money was never the point. Though it pumped a little into the town, the fair, with a budget of about $900,000, operated as a break-even event. He meant that the fair gave individuals a way to define themselves as members of the community at a time when there were few other ways to do so.
That's Brian Alexander, journalist, and reading from his new book. It's entitled Glass House, the 1% Economy and the Shattering of the All-American Town. Of course, as you've gathered, it's about Fairfield County and the city of Lancaster. Brian will be giving a free talk tonight on the Ohio State University campus. For more information, check out WOSU.org/allsides. Joining us now is Ohio State University sociologist Stephen Lopez. He's studied how extended unemployment has affected people's lives in the wake of the Great Recession. He's the author of the 2004 book, Reorganizing the Rust Belt, an inside study of the American labor movement. Stephen Lopez, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You know, when you hear about something like the Fairfield County Fair, you see what keeps people together and what keeps people in those places. But I'm thinking about, you know, the study you've done about people's lives in the wake of the Great Recession and how that applies to a place like Lancaster that was kind of sideswiped back in the late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Is that typical?
Yeah, they're like, as Brian said, you know, there are a whole lot of Lancasters out there in this country. And so that's what makes Brian's book so powerful is that the experience of Lancaster has been repeated again and again across the country. You know, one of the things that stands out to me about the book is that in some cases it's kind of an extreme case analysis that the workers at Anchor Hocking had a lot of advantages. They had a lot of things going for them. You know, they made a product that was difficult to offshore because it's glass is heavy and it breaks, so it's expensive to ship long distances. It took a lot of skill to make that product, and they were organized. They were unionized. They had a strong union, and yet. You know, and so that made them less vulnerable to some of these larger economic forces than workers in a lot of other industries in a lot of other towns. And even they were unable to defend themselves against the depredations of high finance.
Yeah, you know, Brian, when I was reading it, I got the feeling it's, you know, the of course, there's all the metaphorical glass house title to it. But I also got this feeling, this chipping away at it, where people kind of like being boiled alive. They didn't know what was happening to them.
Right. It's been at least a 35-year process at Anchor in Lancaster since the early 1980s.
Yeah. Is that, you know, tell us about the impact of that kind of ending or that kind of effect on a town like this. Steve Lopez?
Well, I think, you know, from my own research focuses on a more distinct event in the lives of workers more recently. And it's connected to the writing that Brian has done in the sense that, the global financial crisis of 2008, the Great Recession and the aftermath of that was also caused by the machinations of high finance. And so I'm looking at the ways that people's lives are sort of been deeply affected by these experiences of downward mobility. And I think that, you know, there's probably a lot of commonalities between the things that my respondents have told me and some of the things that people in places like Lancaster have been going through for a very long time.
What does it matter when sort of the heart of the city's removed, like Newell Corporation did with Anchor Hocking, taking its executives, their spouses, their kids out of the picture?
You know, I think a lot of Americans believed in a kind of social contract, you know, the idea that if we work hard and we play by the rules, our institutions will do right by us. And I think that's the kind of thing that leads people to want to invest and help out, bail out a private company.
Isn't that astounding to even think about?
It is amazing. And the rules of the game changed suddenly in the 1980s. And, you know, our institutions and our corporations sort of reneged on that social contract, not just in Lancaster, but across the country. And, you know, the people I've interviewed more recently who did everything right, you know, who got I interviewed a mix of white collar and blue collar people, but who saved, who you know, were steadily employed. And then found out that none of that counted for anything. People express such bewildered disillusionment that this isn't the way it was supposed to be in this country. And so I think, you know, when the heart is ripped out of a town or the bottom falls out of your life and you feel that you've played by the rules, I think it calls everything into question. What kind of country is this? Who am I? How do I fit in? And I think, as Brian alluded to, voting patterns in the last election, that anger, that disillusionment, the sense that our institutions are not working in the interests of ordinary people, you know, made people want to express outrage against sort of status quo politics.
You know, Brian, one of the things that amazed me, there's so many things about Lancaster and its denizens that amazed me in reading your book.
Some of the greatest people I've ever met are in Lancaster still. I love people in Lancaster.
I loved the stories about how they saved Inkerhocking through these crises that might have – that what were the downfall of some companies at the time. But just the standard of living there was so different. Now, not everybody lived in a fancy house, but most people owned their home.
Oh, yeah. There were very few apartments back in the day. Most people owned their own home. You know, rich people, I.J. Collins, who founded Inkerhocking, lived right in the middle of town. Mm-hmm. You know, he had a very nice house. It was bigger than a lot of other people's houses, but it was nothing like a giant McMansion or any of that sort of stuff. It really was more of a meshed society.
Yeah. Yeah. Steve Lopez?
Well, you know, one of the I think it's tempting to sort of look at what's happened, you know, in places like Lancaster and sort of think, well, these were global economic forces that nobody could do anything about. There's a narrative in our culture that sort of blames unions for what happened. And one of the things that's really clear in Brian's book is that, you know, the unions are not responsible for the destruction of lives in, you know, in Lancaster and the decline of Inkerhocking.
The unions were exploited along with everybody
exactly.
else.
Yeah, exactly. And they weren't able to prevent it, but they're not to blame, right? And one of the, I think a lot of Americans don't realize what an outlier the United States is in several ways, both in terms of the extent of this collapse of living standards for, you know, ordinary working Americans. That's one thing. I mean, Thomas Piketty and Emmanuel Saez, two economists who've gotten a lot of attention over the last couple of years for the data that they've produced, have come out with some recent international comparisons showing, you know, comparing the U.S. and France between 1978 and 2015. The United States has had more income growth than France, but it's been distributed very differently. The bottom half of the French population have seen real income growth of 39% over that period, which is about the average for the population as a whole in France. In the U.S., although total income growth, real income growth was greater during that period, the bottom half of the American population has had negative income growth during that period. So it's not that this is inevitable. This has happened here.
You can have growth and have it distributed, but is that socialism?
No, not it's capitalism. France is a capitalist country,
right.
You know. It's about the institutions that you know, that and the framework for growth that sort of lead to how that growth is distributed. The other way that the U.S. is a really extreme outlier is that we're really the only advanced country, capitalist country, that's had a total collapse of collective bargaining in the private sector during this period. And that those two things are connected.
Right. I mean, workers in South Carolina just voted down a union at a Boeing plant.
Yeah, after hundreds of anti-union ads and so on, right? You know, there was a very strenuous campaign by Boeing to have them not, and a lot of pressure to have them not vote for a union.
Right. I mean, obviously it was politics, you know, on parade, no question about it. But I read an analysis that said that unions reward longevity and seniority. And I'm wondering if that fits into this dysfunction of the paradigm of business today, that there's not longevity and
right.
seniority.
Well, one of the things I think when we look back on the past, the era that Brian describes from his childhood as the era of strong unions. And, you know, the narrative is that, well, unions were too strong and they made American business uncompetitive, and that had to be changed so that American businesses could compete in a global economy. It's really nonsense. The real story is that collective bargaining and trade unions were institutionalized in a much weaker way in the United States than in other advanced capitalist countries. In a couple of ways. First of all, unlike other advanced countries, we never had a national framework for industrial relations. The non-union South had a different set of rules, so we really didn't have the same sort of industrial relations system in the South that we had in the North. right to work, and so on.
Is it because you knew they had to break through piece by piece, mill by mill kind of a thing?
No, no. I mean, because states were permitted by the Taft-Hartley Act of 1947 to pass right to work laws, the non-union South remained non-union. So it was easy for companies to start moving capital to the South to get away from areas of worker strength right after World War II, and they did. Another way, you know, in terms of sector, the Taft-Hartley Amendment sort of locked trade unions into the sectors where they were already strong in 1947, making it very, very difficult to organize new sectors as they arose. That's not true in other countries, even in Canada. You know, the economy changes, service sector jobs grow, and collective bargaining moves into the new parts of the economy. In the U.S., you know, we have this idea that service sector jobs can't be organized. Well, it's because of the framework for collective bargaining, which makes it almost impossible to organize unions in new sectors. So in that, you know, the U.S. is a really extreme outlier in that way.
Brian Alexander, how did the unions respond to the circumstances that were put before them back in 1987 when the Newell Corporation took over?
There's, you know, a long version of that story. It's not all one direction or another.
Right.
But the trend line overall has been that the union has been walking backwards. The union has
been— To just keep the jobs.
Yep. They have been basically playing a rear guard action to try to protect what they can protect. And, you know, they give concessions after concessions. They did just get a new contract that did improve upon the last contract. But that really brought them only back to a level of – they're still not where they were earlier. In fact, if you do it on a dollar value basis, many of the workers are making less than they made in the 1970s.
Pretty much. What do they make? I mean, what is the average? What are they taking home?
The very top guy, the very experienced guys.
In the factory.
In the factory. Lots of longevity, skilled position, can make about $22 an hour, roughly speaking. That's not exact. A starter guy, let's say you're a floor boy, you might make $12, $13 an hour. And that can be a floor boy who spends a lot of time in what's called the hot end near the furnace room.
Dangerous.
And so on. So by the time you pay your union dues, if you want to get into the health insurance plan, which is now extra expensive. There was actually a complaint to the National Labor Relations Board about a year and a half ago saying that it was far too expensive, taxes and so on. You can barely eke out a living. A guy who plays a big part in the book, a fellow by the name of Brian, I think we've become pretty good friends. I like Brian a lot. He's a young man. He was living with his mom and dad. He was working full time, union job, making glass, and had to live with his mom and dad.
He's the artist, right?
Yep.
We're talking about Lancaster, Ohio. Maybe we're talking about the United States in general and the towns that we used to think of as the all-American towns and what's happened to them. You just heard from Brian Alexander. He's a journalist and the author of a new book depicting the status, the circumstances in Lancaster, Ohio now. It's entitled Glass House, the 1% Economy and the Shattering of the All-American Town. Also with us is Stephen Lopez. He's a sociologist at Ohio State University. He studied the impact of the downturns like the Great Recession on the lifestyles of Americans. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The glassware company Anchor Hocking was formed, formed the economic heart of Lancaster, Ohio, about a half hour southeast of Columbus. And the people of Lancaster were the lifeblood of that city. Back in the late 1980s, Lancaster had a heart attack. When corporate raiders picked off Inkerhocking, gutted its leadership, and took from the town the economic balance that had earned it a spread in the 30th anniversary issue of Forbes magazine in 1947. It was once the all-American town. And maybe it still is. It's just that the definition of all-American town has changed. Still with us is OSU sociologist Stephen Lopez and journalist and author Brian Alexander. His new book about the changing face of Lancaster and other many, many other towns like it, really, is entitled Glass House, The 1% Economy and the Shattering of the All-American Town. Now, Brian Alexander, we talked earlier that Lancaster is still a pretty town. It's got a lot going for it. It's got history. It has a reference point with something, one of the fastest growing cities in the country, Columbus.
Right.
It's not all bad by any means. And I learned a lot about that just from reading about these wonderful people who live there.
Yeah. I mean, the best thing going for Lancaster is how much people still love their town.
They stay.
They love it. They want to try to make it better. They're not always sure exactly how to go about that. They're up against forces outside of the town that they really have very little control over. But when they do, when they are able to take a local initiative, they really do try to get some programs going, sort of both government and just sort of charity programs. I am somewhat optimistic about Lancaster's future, and I hope if any business people are listening and looking for a great place to go locate their business or startup, they give the people in Lancaster a call.
I think it was in your book that someone said that they voted for Donald Trump or they supported Donald Trump because they just want things to go back to the way they were, and they believed he brought that promise with him. Stephen Lopez, can things go back to the way they were for cities like Lancaster?
Well, I don't know if they can go back to the way they were, and in some ways, maybe they shouldn't. I mean, one of the things Brian writes about is the sort of history of racial inequality in Lancaster, which is not that different from lots of other places. But if you look at the structure of the workforce in Lancaster City now, I was just looking at this yesterday, just out of curiosity. About a quarter of the jobs in Lancaster are managerial and professional. And the median income for those jobs is about $42,000 a year. Modest, not bad. About another quarter is production and transportation workers, the kind of remnants of the industrial working class. The median income for those jobs is high 20s.
Not good.
Not good enough. And the bottom half of the jobs in Lancaster are service and sales jobs whose median income is about $22,000 a year. So what you really have is a situation where about 75% of the jobs, and again, Lancaster isn't unique in this respect, don't pay enough to meet a basic needs budget for a family of four. And that's, that needs to change. We can go back to having strong communities and strong towns, but not when three quarters of the workers don't make enough to support a family. And there's no reason that nursing home workers and custodial workers and food service workers have to make such low wages that they need public assistance in order to buy groceries.
And this brings up, I think, an important point, really the larger question that I hope the book helps start a conversation about, and that is, what do we want capitalism to do for us? I personally happen to be a capitalist. I believe in what I call the old version of capitalism. What's it supposed to do? And what are the goals of it?
What's so great about it?
Right. And if we have a set of goals in mind that we think capitalism is supposed to do for us, we tend to think about the old capitalism. But we have another kind of new sort of parallel or shadow system to what I call the old capitalism. And it doesn't do those things for us. So let's define, what are we supposed to get out of capitalism? How do we make that happen again?
Beth in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Beth.
Hi. Nice to hear from you, Ann. Yeah, actually, that was what I was just thinking, because I know a lot of people, and I've talked to people myself, right, in Columbus and in other, I know in other cities. There's this one young woman that I met at a Wendy's, and I was having a hard day, and I was waiting for my order, and she was working two jobs, just to keep food on the table. She said, I want to make a good example for my kid.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't, you know, I mean, I believe that since things have been stagnant for so long, that something has to change. Otherwise, it's just, and I want to believe that people deserve just basic things, a good roof over their head, clean clothes, food in the fridge, and that's not too much to ask. And it doesn't make them less than without, you know, and not have to use government assistance, because nobody wakes up and goes, oh, yay, I can't wait to be on, you know
right.
what I mean?
Steve Stover?
Yes. You know, capitalism isn't going to provide those things for ordinary people unless without collective bargaining. Collective bargaining is viewed across the advanced capitalist world as a normal part of economic life. It's the only way individuals, ordinary people, can confront large corporations on any kind of an equal playing field. That's what we've lost.
Their stake is the labor force, and that's their power.
Why does somebody who works at Wendy's make a poverty wage here, but in Denmark, you know, a fast food worker makes over $20 an hour equivalent? It's because their collective bargaining is a normal part of economic life there. That's what we've lost.
And that's what happened in Lancaster. Very strong parallel with Lancaster. So before the Wagner Act, before the New Deal, a lot of anchor, then it was the Hawking Glass Company, a lot of those workers had very poor working conditions. They were paid much less than workers in other areas. The New Deal comes in, the Wagner Act gets passed, unions form in Lancaster, and suddenly there's a bit of more of a balance between labor and management. As a result, they made more money. Also, as a result, they could afford to support Main Street stores and so on. And that really helped create the prosperity of Lancaster.
Passed countless levies,
school bond issues, new sidewalks, new streets.
By huge percentages.
Because people made more money.
Steve Lopez, I'm sorry I referred you as Steve Stover.
It's okay.
I'm sorry about that. Beth, thanks for that call. Richard in Chillicothe, you're on the air. Hi, Richard.
Good morning. I'm a lifetime resident of Ross County, and I see Ross County and its county seat, Chillicothe, as very parallel to Fairfield County and
Absolutely.
Lancaster.
Yeah.
Chillicothe and Ross County have been supported by papermaking. We could call it the paper house, I guess, instead of the glass house.
Mm-hmm.
Mead Paper Corporation from the 1800s was strong. It is unionized. We also have Kenworth Truck Plant, and we have Edina Regional Medical Center as the three primary employers. What I'm wondering is, what can the community here in Ross County and Chillicothe do ahead of time to head off the cycle that that we're hearing about this morning in Lancaster?
Richard, is it also parallel in the sense that the core of those organizations live outside of Ross County, outside of Chillicothe?
Indeed, Chillicothe has lost population, Chillicothe proper. Mm-hmm. But the villages and the subdivisions in the surrounding areas are I think, holding steady or maybe increasing slightly.
So, Stephen Lopez, the trajectory that we've been on since the 80s of having absentee ownership, for lack of a better word, can be offset to some extent with workers being organized.
Yeah,
to protect their stake in it.
But you know, the system we have for organizing workers into unions in this country is broken. I mean, it doesn't. The workers have to run a gauntlet. We're the only advanced country in the world where employers get to campaign against unionization, right? And have closed door meetings where they can intimidate their workers. It's a very difficult and gut wrenching thing to try to accomplish. Honestly, you know, it's a great question from the caller. I don't think there's much at the local level that communities can do to to just prevent what happened to Lancaster from happening to their town. These are the results of the way that our national institutions work.
Richard, thanks for the call. An email from Robin, to your point, Brian Alexander. She says, I am a Columbus resident who works in Lancaster. Although the city has issues like many cities in Ohio and the United States are experiencing, the city is by no means in the midst of dying. I feel this statement is greatly inappropriate and could negatively influence an individual's perception of the city, especially an individual who has limited knowledge of the area. I recommend visiting Lancaster. Although issues might exist, the city has so much to offer. Just take a look at its downtown. Now, I don't know who she's talking about because, of course, you grew up there and as you said already, you're very fond of it.
I agree with her. Lancaster has great potential.
Is it dying?
No. People all over Lancaster said their nadir, their worst years were 2008, 2009.
The recession.
And they've been clawing their way back since then, partly through some small local initiatives, partly because they have increasingly become a bedroom community for Columbus. Most people go the opposite way from the emailer. They live at one of the subdivisions of Lancaster and drive up to Columbus to work and drive back. But again, that does affect the social structure of the town because there's a little less time for people to be involved locally and civically because they get in their car in the morning, drive to Columbus, work in Columbus, pay taxes up here, and drive back. And by then, they're exhausted. They don't want to go to a lot of board meetings and so on at the end of a day like that.
Does any of this have anything to do with the physical infrastructure of a city? You know, the bypass went through. It went through pretty much all the way down to Ohio University now in Athens. You don't really have to stop in Lancaster or get stuck in that traffic anymore. But you also can just pretend like it's not even there now.
Yeah, a lot of people do pretend that it's not even there. They should. They should turn off on Main Street and take a little look at downtown Lancaster. It's still a beautiful place. A
lot of history.
Yeah.
A lot of history. Now, email from Mary. She says, isn't there something missing in your discussion of the political transformation of the people to join the laissez-faire Republicans that caused their downfall? Does anybody even talk about this now? I remember in the Reagan years, they actually talked about this. I don't think anybody actually talks that way anymore, that this is a good thing, what Carl Icahn did. And
well, I'm not sure I understand the question exactly.
Discussion of the political transformation of the people to join the laissez-faire Republicans that caused their downfall. I guess he's saying Rush Limbaugh in the 1980s, that kind of a thing. But if people kind of started to embrace the very thing that was hurting them.
See. Well, you know, Brian can speak to this too. But, you know, we've been bathed in media messages and not just media messages. You know, our most prestigious economists have been telling us for 30 years that unregulated markets will bring prosperity to everyone. You know, that's something that, you know, is not just coming from Rush Limbaugh. That's
no.
coming from Martin Feldstein and other.
Well, it's coming from executive orders from the president of the United States now.
Right. But that idea has been given great intellectual prestige. And, you know, I think as Brian said, it didn't provide benefits the benefits it promised to ordinary people, quite the opposite.
There was a tendency to believe that if you just had no regulations, that the self-interest of business people, business industry would naturally lead like a sort of a force of nature to benefits for all and that they would not act to exploit people unfairly and so on. But nobody really lives their life that way. I mean, that's actually
anymore.
Yeah,
they don't live there anymore.
Right. I mean, think about before we had rules and regulations. Think about the meatpacking industry in the late 1800s, or before the institution of the Food and Drug Administration. Business exploited and endangered people all the time, and so rules and regulations are important.
You know, there's a kind of a free market myth. You know, there's this sort of idea that that the invisible hand of the market will provide wondrous benefits to everyone. By acting in my own interest in the market, I will contribute to the general interest. And, you know, that's an elegant and beautiful economic theory, but it depends on assumptions that in the real world aren't met. You know, it depends on perfect competition, which means lots of buyers and sellers in every market so that no buyer or seller can dominate the market. It depends on perfect information. It depends on a whole host of assumptions that don't apply in the real world. In the real world, we have huge multinational corporations that distort labor markets with their market power. And so, you know, the theory of the invisible hand doesn't apply in the same way to that situation. So without representation for working people, without regulations, those are ways of trying to correct those distortions in markets rather than distortions of the markets themselves.
Stephen Lopez, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
That's Stephen Lopez. He's a sociologist at Ohio State University. Also, Brian Alexander, thanks to you. Appreciate your time as well.
It was great to be here.
Brian Alexander is a journalist, author of a new book. It's entitled Glass House, The 1% Economy and the Shattering of the All-American Town. He'll be giving a free talk tonight at the Ohio State University campus. For more information, go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Shyla Knott, All Sides interns Sarah Stacy, Kyle McKinnon, Emily Sink, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.